Working Cows Podcast, episode 114.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And if you missed it in the outro of last week's show, I did share, or 2 weeks ago, I think it was, I did share that I'll be attending Wally Olson's marketing school in Claremore, Oklahoma on November 12th through the 15th. So if there's still room and you're interested, I think Wally would still take new participants in that class. So maybe look up his website at OlsonRanchLLC.com, and it would be cool to meet some people down there who are listeners to the show. So on to today's show. We are talking with Dave Pratt. I don't know how to say this necessarily, but he's the newly minted emeritus leader of Ranch Management Consultants, former owner and leader of Ranch Management Consultants, the organization behind the Ranching for Profit School and the Executive Link program and a host of other programs. And I decided I'd like to talk to Dave a little bit today about some of the monuments to tax avoidance that we might be tripping over around our place, extra metal that we don't need to run our ranch businesses that we buy just to keep from paying taxes. And also thought it would be interesting to get some perspective on Dave having a little bit of time to digest some of the things he's learned in 25 years of leading Ranching for Profit. So, Dave, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We're coming up on the end of the year, and some people maybe are even thinking about strategizing how they're going to manage their tax bill for the 2019 production year, and there might be some opportunity to get some bad advice. And what's some of the bad advice that typically people receive from their accountant when it comes to managing their tax liabilities?
Well, you know, it's the end of the year because I was in Lowe's the other day looking for some lumber, and they already had Christmas displays up. that's just not right. That's wrong. You know, we think making a profit is a good thing. That taxes are a problem you ought to invite, that we ought to aspire to have tax problems. There's three things when it comes to money. There's economics, and in economics, the question is really simple. It's just, is this thing profitable? And the corollary is, how do I make it more profitable? Then there's finance, and finance is the question of, can I afford to do this? In other words, where's the capital going to come from to get this thing going? And then how does the cash flow, you know, if I make a profit, but it all happens at the end of the year, how do I pay my expenses in the meantime? So economics is the question of, should I do this thing? You know, is it profitable? Whereas finance is the question of, can I do this thing? And then the third issue when it comes to money, or what's the tax consequences? And sometimes I think we put those in reverse order. You know, we're so obsessed with avoiding taxes that we do some pretty silly things. And then the second question we usually ask ourselves is the finance question. Can I do it? And we hardly ever get around to that first question of, should I do it? We get them in exactly the wrong order. We ought to be asking, should I do this thing? Does it make a profit? Can I do this thing? And then, okay, now how do I deal with the taxes? And I'm not saying we ought not do what we can to minimize our tax liability, but let's not do it at the expense of making a profit. I'll give you an example. There's a ranch. Oh, I won't tell you where it is. I don't think the owners would appreciate me giving away who this is. But they had this huge, I don't even know what you call it, but this huge roller that you pull behind like a D8 or something like that to crush sagebrush. And these guys are obsessed with sagebrush. You know, let's kill all the sagebrush. And so they had this D8. And by the way, no one ever went broke because they had sagebrush. So anyway, they had this big crusher. I think it cost like $35,000, $40,000. and it looked brand new. And I said, wow, that's an impressive piece of equipment. It doesn't look like it's been used. When did you buy it? He said, well, we bought that 4 years ago. 4 years ago, it doesn't look like it's been used. Yeah, well, we don't have a tractor big enough to pull it. Why did you buy it? Well, to keep from paying taxes, to reduce their tax liability. Now, that thing probably cost $40,000. So, you know, so it reduced their tax liability. Let's say they're in, you know, I don't know what kind of tax bracket is, and I don't know what the state taxes would be. Let's say it's the 30%. All right. So 30% of $40,000 is $12,000. Okay. So maybe it reduced their tax liability by $12,000. So you could argue that instead of $40,000, it really only cost them $28,000. But let's take a look at that $40,000 or that $28,000 that it cost them. If they had, let's say they invested that in water development or in fencing, and I'm making some big assumptions here, but let's just say that they improved distribution so that, or they were able to get more precise control of time. So they got the rest periods a little bit longer and maybe the graze periods a little bit shorter and stock density up just a little bit. And let's say that resulted in, I don't know, a 5% increase in carrying capacity. For $28,000 in an operation that size, I'll bet you could make enough improvements to do at least that. Well, if this is, say, a 400 cow outfit, then a 5% improvement is 20 more cows. 20 more cows with a gross margin, and let's guess the gross margin is $500 a year. That's $10,000 a year. So by making that decision, those 4 years that they had that piece of equipment, that could have been $40,000 of additional profit, because that gross margin, those overheads are already covered. So that's $40,000 of additional gross margin with the overheads already covered. So that's $40,000 of additional profit in order to save $12,000 of taxes. Where, you know, in any other industry, that's nothing but lunacy. In agriculture, it's normal. It's just absolutely insane. In fact, I talk about these things as monuments to tax avoidance. And I think American farms and ranches are loaded with monuments to tax avoidance. And then I asked them, get this, they, you know, after I talked to them about this, these guys had been through the school, they should have known better. I said, so why do you still have this thing? If you haven't used it in 4 years, why do you still have this thing? And their response is, well, someday we might get a tractor big enough to pull it. And I'm sure that advice will come from their accountant too. Mm. But anyway, the other piece on this same place is that they are obsessed with sagebrush, and they're doing all sorts of things to try to control sagebrush. And the grandfather is the guy that's really driving this, and he's, you know, the younger family members. And this is nothing against the older folks, but this is one that there's not a lot of great communication in this family. And I think the younger generation is trying to just get, you know, let's get them out in the pasture. Let's get them away from running the business and all these things. So they set them out on a tractor to spray sagebrush. And there maybe half hour left to go in the day. The tractor's starting to overheat. And rather than let it cool off, the old man keeps driving it, and it catches on fire. And it starts a fire and burns about 500 acres of sagebrush. So they killed the sagebrush. But now here comes in it's beautiful now. It's all this lupin, perennial lupin, which happens to be poisonous. And and you see that sort of thing all, you know, over and over again. In our attempt to kill this thing, we create something that's even worse. And that, you know, that's another topic for another day. But just to maybe bait the hook a little bit, agriculture has really become the business of trying to kill things instead of trying to grow things. You know, no one ever went broke because they had sagebrush. No one ever went broke because they made a profit and had to pay taxes.
Right. It might have been an opportunity to bring in another profit center or another enterprise that could, like maybe a neighbor who has sheep would come in and graze some of that sagebrush instead of trying to mechanically deal with the problem. You might have been able to deal with it biologically.
Yeah, regardless of what it is, the goal ought not be to kill stuff. It ought to be to grow stuff. And, you know, sagebrush is not making that place unhealthy. The sagebrush is there, at least in the densities it's in, because the place is unhealthy. And you don't make a place healthier by killing stuff. That's another topic for, you know, that's a whole nother podcast or two.
Right. So. Yeah. No, there's a lot of people who've come to that realization. I woke up every morning and my job was, what am I going to kill today? And everything that I was working on had a side at the end of it. Well, it's homicide. There's pesticide, fungicide, herbicide. So it's all killing. Yeah. Very, very much something that we got to change our thinking on, for sure. So what are some good ways to manage a tax liability? Or maybe we should talk a little bit about the questions we should be asking first before we talk about taxes. We should maybe talk about economics and then finance, kind of get things in the right order, as you said.
You know, I'm not a great person to give tax advice. one of the questions I like to ask folks is, what kind of cost are taxes? You know, when it comes to income tax, what kind of cost is that? You know, overheads are costs that don't change very much as the units of production change. Land and labor costs are overheads. Direct costs are costs that change directly as the units change. So you have more cows, you have more feed, you have more vaccine. Those are direct costs. Capital expenses are things that you intend to keep, equipment, machinery, breeding stock, fences, infrastructure. Those are capital expenses. Those aren't economic costs. Those are financial costs. The depreciation on those things are economic costs. So what kind of cost is income tax? And the answer is, it's a dividend. It's really a dividend to your partner. And people may not like it, but the government is providing roads, it's providing fire protection, it's providing the infrastructure that allows our industry to operate. It provides regulation that some people feel is onerous and other people feel keep the playing field level. And I'm not going to weigh in on that one. But so you may not like your business partner, although I remember having a conversation with a gentleman from Wyoming who was very anti-regulation, very anti-government. Stan Parsons was there visiting from Zimbabwe. And in Zimbabwe, the government was in chaos. Inflation was running at something like 1,000%. It was just, the whole country was in meltdown. And the guy was just starting to rail about the such and such government in the U.S. And Stan got in his face and said, you don't like the government? You just try living in a place without a government. that kind of ended that conversation for a while. But I think you're right. I think economics and finance have to come first. Let's make this thing profitable. My wife writes the tax check, I don't write the tax check, but I see how much it is. And when that check goes in, it's like, ooh, that hurt. And then I realize, oh, wait, I'm paying those taxes because I made a profit. And I do enjoy that there's a Federal Aeronautics Administration and there's I can't even think what they call it, the controller at the airport when I fly out there to make sure that mm-hmm. two planes don't bump into one another. I'm grateful that that's there. I guess that's what I'm paying to my partner to make sure I can operate my business. Sometimes people don't like their partner, but I do appreciate that I live in in this country and that I have a reasonably level playing field to operate my company. And so, there are things you can do to prepay expenses and things like that. And I don't have a big problem with that, but sooner or later, you're going to pay the tax. Right. I've got IRAs and things like that that we've put money into that, reduce some of the tax liability, but someday you're going to pay the tax. We can shove it off to another generation sometimes, but I think we're shoving an awful lot of problems onto another generation that, that we ought to be sucking it up and doing something about ourselves.
Yeah, I think that, a lot of what we're talking about here today is really the unintended consequence. You've got an intervention somewhere on your place and you are the intervener, and there is an unintended consequence as a result of that. And I think that if we are paying attention to the numbers side of things and making sure that we're profitable, then maybe those unintended consequences are a little bit less of a hiccup than if we are barely squeaking by.
You're preaching to the choir on that one.
and I also think that as far as the government as a business partner. I think, you know, I tend to be fairly conservative in that regard. But if the tax burden or if the government is the reason your business failed, it probably wasn't the reason the business failed.
No, income tax has never been a reason the business failed. I hate to play the same tune over and over again, but no one ever went broke because they had sagebrush, and no one ever went broke because they had to pay income tax.
Right. It's an excuse. And I think that for a long time, that has been the modus operandi of the agriculturalist, is to make excuses rather than figuring out how to make a profit.
Yeah. I got invited to, I got invited to speak on a program recently, and it's a fairly traditional organization. And the person who invited me is a graduate of the school, and he thought this is going to shake things up. And so they, my impression was I was going to be doing a workshop in the afternoon. They relegated me to a much more minor role, which is fine. But they said that they just had too much going on to make room for a workshop. And I looked at the agenda, and it's all stuff on government policy and on regulation and public lands and things like this. Essentially, most of the speakers are talking about things that people can't do anything about.
Right. Yes. No
yeah,
doubt.
It just occurred to me that I think I was the only one who was going to talk about things that they could actually do something about. I mean, the other things are important to be informed about. But sometimes I think the three things that people talk at the Cattlemen's Association and other programs like that are, you know, weather, prices, and the government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Those are the three things you can't do a thing about. And they're right. They're the three things we don't talk about at the Ranching for Profit School. Yeah. I mean, we will talk about the things you can do about weather. You know, when you're in drought, there are things you can do to prepare for it and manage through it. But we're not going to focus on things you can't do something about. We're going to find the thing you can do something about and take steps to deal with it. So anyway, I'm kind of taking us down the rabbit trail here.
That's fine. I have anecdotal evidence that whenever I post something on the Working Cows Facebook page about weather, the interaction is orders of magnitude higher than if I post something about you don't have to be a victim. You can be a proactive person who is managing a business that makes a profit, you know, it's just the default setting, I think, where people are so good at interacting with something about weather or prices or government that they don't maybe don't have a lot of mental or intellectual capacity left to devote to thinking about how they could do something about what they can control.
Well, it's easy to want to blame our situation on someone else, you know, as opposed to rolling up our sleeves and taking responsibility and doing something about it.
So. Yeah, that's why my favorite quote has always been, and I don't know who said it originally, but he who is good for making excuses is seldom good for anything else. So generally, these things that we do to avoid taxes, these monuments to tax avoidance, fall into a certain category of depreciating assets. And
right.
So I think that managing overheads and managing depreciation is a logical next portion of this conversation. And can we talk a little bit about that, about how people are doing a good job of managing overheads and fixed costs?
Sure. And we don't use the F word. At the school, we don't use the word fixed costs. Because what does the term fixed imply?
That you can't do anything about it.
That's right, and we're not going to tolerate that. The fixed says they're fixed. You can't do anything about them, and of course, you can do things about them. Now, talk to an economist, and I've had economists scold me for this. I had one offer to come in and redesign our curriculum to straighten this out, to say that, no, there are such things as fixed costs, and I had it all wrong. That same day, that was in response to an article I wrote, and I can't remember the name, but it was something about overheads are not fixed, or there's no such thing as a fixed cost. That same day I had that the economist chewed me out, I had an email from one of our Australian graduates And his response was, that was the best piece of advice anybody ever gave me. Hmm. To challenge those overheads and find ways to change them. Because overheads account for 60 to 80% of the cost in most ranches. Overheads being land and labor costs. And when I say land costs, I'm talking about all the stuff that is attached to the land. You know, fences, pipelines, water developments, buildings. That's we consider those all land costs. And then labor costs are, that's not just people, that's the equipment, things that people use. I was blown away when I was in Zimbabwe and I was on a mixed farm there with 700 employees. And the labor costs were nearly identical to a farm of similar size in Kansas or Nebraska, you know, where they're putting up the same crops, except in Nebraska or Kansas, it's one employee and a bunch of machinery, as opposed to Zimbabwe, where it's 700 or 800 employees getting paid 75 cents a day or whatever it was. But it was interesting that the labor costs on the equal size farm, about the same productivity, were roughly the same. Hmm. But overheads are, you know, if it's 60 to 80% of the costs in a business, then overheads are definitely a challenge. I was talking to this with Dallas Mount, the fellow that just bought Ranch Management Consultants and is going to be driving it into the future. And we were talking about the approach of, that most people take to increase profit. If I have a business that generates $100,000 of income and I have $80,000 of expenses, leaving a $20,000 profit, most people would say, well, in order to double profit, I guess I have to double the size of my business. I have to make $200,000 gross income and I'll have $160,000 in expenses and there's my $40,000 profit. But people fail to realize that there's another way to double profit, and that would be to cut the costs by 25%. So if I can go from $80,000 of cost, and I don't know if I could do this, but if I could go from 80 to 60, well, there's my $40,000 profit. And now let's double the size of this business. And now it's an $80,000 profit. And here's the added advantage of that. Now let's say prices go in the tank, or I'm in drought, and some other severe occurrence happens in my business. To anybody who's built a business based on prices, you know, that I've got to expand this thing to be more profitable, as opposed to cutting costs to be more profitable, they're at the mercy of the market. But that business that started by cutting costs and got the right structure in place before increasing scale, that business can withstand a crash in prices. That business is much more risk tolerant than a business that has just than the high cost. There's two models you can go. You can go high cost, high output, or high input, high output. But that's a very vulnerable business. And you go low input and probably lower output, but not necessarily. There's a lot of low input businesses that are pretty productive. I did have a letter I shared with Dallas the other day. I keep a file of letters that of people talking about their experience at the school. And there's a nice big fat one of people who had compliments or had talked about the impact, the positive impact the school has. And there's a very narrow file of people who had a bad experience. And actually, I looked inside that file because, you know, cleaning up the office and Dallas is moving the operation to Wyoming. So we've been cleaning things up here. And so I've been a little nostalgic looking through stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I noticed in that complaint file, there was only one letter. And the guy accused me of ruining his business. And his brother had been to a workshop that I had done, and he left with the message, apparently, that cutting costs will increase profit. And I know that's not, listeners may think that that's what I just said, but that's not what I said. I'm not talking about indiscriminately cutting costs. You cannot starve a profit into a business. You cannot starve a profit into a business. And this guy had just, I guess, just willy-nilly started cutting costs indiscriminately. But anyway, so I actually wrote him a pretty reasoned letter in response. I must have been in a good mood that day. But anyway, the thing about overheads, in one respect, the economists are right. They are fixed. Now, let me tell you what I'm talking about here. I'm telling you out of two sides of my mouth. One, I'm telling you they're not fixed. And on the other side, I'm telling you they are. If I have a cow-calf enterprise, and I'm going to calve in March, and I'm in South Dakota or Nebraska or Montana or Wyoming, I am going to feed hay. Mm-hmm. And that means I'm going to have equipment and I'm going to have labor, right? there's no way about it. I might be able to save a little bit on diesel, or maybe be a little more efficient with the way I get that hay used, and maybe I can put it out. Maybe I can do bale grazing and something like that and get a little more efficient with the way I do it. And maybe tweak those overheads a little bit. But if I'm going to have a real breakthrough, if I'm going to really substantially slash those costs, I'm not going to be able to calve in March. I'm going to have to calve in May or June. Now, if I calve in May or June, I may need some hay. I'm not saying people ought not have hay. They ought to have, like this building that I'm in has a fire alarm. And if there's a fire, you know, there's not a fireman running up and down the halls with a charged hose 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. There's a contingency here, and it's called pull the fire alarm. But the way most people run their ranches, it's as though they are prepared, not only prepared, but they're managing as though it was going to be the worst year every year. And because of that, they have these huge overheads, huge capital expense and lots of overheads. And it's only by getting in sync with the forage cycle. And it's an overused phrase these days. I mean, we've been talking about it for 40 years, but to get in sync with nature, it's only by doing that that you're going to lower the overheads, and you'll lower them substantially. And that may mean you don't have cows. That may mean that you go to a seasonal stocker operation, or maybe a custom. Maybe you do have cows, but maybe they're not your cows and they're there seasonally. You know, would nature have a resident herd on this place year round, or would it be a migratory herd? And of course, with, you know, migratory herd, that may mean you're trucking them 400 miles to winter range somewhere, or, mm-hmm. or to summer range somewhere. Or maybe we just go seasonal. But those are the types of things, you know, as if I'm not willing to challenge my enterprise mix or the structure of those enterprises, I will not be able to change overheads significantly. In that case, they are fixed. The only way to change overheads is by challenging the basic structure of the business. And in that case, they're not fixed at all. They can radically change.
Is 60-80% too high in your mind? I mean, is that just a reality we have to accept? Or I guess that's why they're called overhead instead of fixed costs, because it's not a reality we have to accept. But
yeah,
I think as long as
that's the case, we're in trouble. I think it partly depends on the output that we get. For example, there's another way to measure. Here's two measures for overheads. First of all, overheads ought to be less than, if you take a look at the gross, and it's hard to do math verbally, there's a tool we use called gross product, or a statistic we use called gross product. It's more than just gross product measures the value an enterprise produces. It's really simple to calculate. All you do is take the closing inventory value of the animals, subtract the opening inventory value, you add to that the sales, and you subtract from that the livestock purchases, the replacement costs. And that's how you calculate gross product. And what it measures is the gross value an enterprise produces. It's not enough just to look at gross income, because what if you retain your heifers? Or what if you retain your steer calves this year? You know, last year you sold them all, but this year you retained them all. Well, they still have value, and you need to account for that. So gross product's a pretty important term. Here's the way to tell if your overheads are too high. The benchmark we use is 40%. If your overhead, the benchmark business, which are the most profitable businesses in our program, the average overhead ratio, and the overhead ratio is overheads divided by gross product, 40%. We don't want the overhead, in a benchmark business, the overhead ratio will be about 40%, which means that, let's say my gross product is $100,000. It better be a lot higher than that, but let's just make the math easy. Let's say gross product is $100,000. That means my land and labor costs would be less than $40,000. All right.
Yep.
So that's how to now that's really aggressive. You got to figure the benchmark businesses are really, really profitable, and you don't have to be a benchmark business to be profitable. Those are the most profitable businesses in our industry. And let me clarify one thing. That doesn't mean that if you own the land that you don't have land costs. If you own the land, your cows still have to rent it. They have to rent it at market rate rent. And so if we're looking at the overhead ratio for the first thing we do is separate the land from the operating business. We separate the land investment from the operating business. And that operating business is going to rent the land. And if you own the land, they're going to pay the same rent to you, to your land investment, that they would have to pay to rent your neighbor's ranch. They're going to pay at the same rent. So just because you own land doesn't mean you get to hide that little cost away or pretend it doesn't exist. So that 40% is paying market rate rent, and it's paying the full cost of labor too. You've got to pay yourself what it would cost to replace yourself. There's no such thing as free family labor anymore, at least not if you're ranching for profit. So that's the overhead ratio. And I would say if a business had 50%, if overheads were 50% of gross product, then that's a pretty good business. The problems really start creeping in when you get up in the 65, 70, 75, 80% range. When overheads are that high, you're not going to make a profit. And if you include the real land and labor costs that most people have, most businesses are going to be up in that 70, 80% range. And we've had people through the school where their overhead ratio is 120% or more, which means that for every dollar of value their business generates, their overhead costs alone are $1.20. And of course, that's not unusual. I mean, people might think, wow, those guys are in crisis. Well, economically they are, but you know, this is most people, most of your listeners probably are subsidizing their ranches. You know, I'll bet you most listeners to your podcast have overhead ratios that are over 80%, a lot of them probably over 100%. And they're doing just fine. And the reason they're doing fine is because they don't pay themselves. They rely on off-farm income. A lot of them inherited what they started with, and so they don't have to pay rent for the land. And you might think that that's okay, but when it comes time to bring in another generation, if this thing isn't making a true economic profit, the next generation's smart enough to say, I'm not going to work for nothing. I'm not going to have two jobs off the farm so that I can support my ranching habit. I don't consider that a matter of being lazy. I consider that a matter of being smart.
Right.
Anyway, I'm kind of navigating all over the place here, but overheads are a big issue. Overheads are a big issue. That's the way to figure out if your overheads are too high. I wouldn't put too much weight on the benchmarks because I really don't think people ought to worry about being a benchmark business. They ought to just worry about being profitable enough to do what they need to do. And I think that 50% on the overheads is a pretty good place to start. If my overheads are over 50% of the value my business produces, then I've got a problem. Now, is it land or is it labor? And there's a way to figure that one out too. I joke with people, except it's not really a joke. I tell people, don't hire people to work. Hire people to produce results. Work is simply a means to an end. If I can produce results without work, awesome. That's great. I've had guys brag, and I may have talked to you about this before, but I've had guys brag and wear it like a badge of honor that I haven't taken a vacation in 20 years. You know, and to me, I just think, wow, is it really that bad a business that it's so dependent on you? The way we put it at the school is you cannot run a sustainable business on unsustainable effort. Mm-hmm. So we work to produce results. At least that's why we should work. And those results can be quantified. We have to be able to measure the value of those results. And we do that by looking at the gross margin or the gross product that enterprises produce. And the benchmark we use is, let's say that you and I are brothers and our dad's involved and your wife is full-time and let's say my wife is half-time. So that's four full-time people and one half-time person. We would say that's 4.5 FTEs, or what we call full-time equivalents, right? Let's say we have a seasonal irrigator, right? And he's full-time, but he only works for 6 months. All right, so there's another half. So that gets us up to 5 FTEs. So what I'll do is take my total gross product, the total value of my business produced, and divide it by 5 to get the total gross product per full-time employee or full-time equivalent. That's a pretty useful statistic. So let's say my business makes, let's make the math easy. Let's say my gross product's $1 million. So divide that by 5 FTEs, that's $200,000 per FTE. All right, that's how you calculate it. The benchmark is $250,000. $250,000 per FTE of gross product per FTE. That's where we wanna be. Mm-hmm. Now, if my business is say we produce $500,000 of income, then that my 5 FTEs, that's $100,000 per FTE. I'm in trouble. If you take a look at what it costs to hire, just let's not even worry about a manager right now. Let's just hire a hand. You know, I'm probably looking at, I don't know, every number is going to be wrong. I'm $2,500. $3,000, $3,500 a month, something like that. Depends on where you are. If I'm up in Montana or in California, it might be more. If I'm in Oklahoma or Texas might be a little less. But let's say I pay $3,000 a month. That's $36,000 a year. But then I've got payroll taxes and I've got insurance. And that guy drives a truck and I got to pay insurance on that truck and that truck depreciates. And now there's housing and there's a side of beef that goes in the freezer and there's a set of dogs and some horses. And by the time I'm done with it, that $36,000 a year employee is costing me about $80,000 a year to employ. And if the value my employees produce is only $100,000, well, they just barely covered the cost of employing them. So here's the two rules. The first one is this overheads as a percentage of gross product. And like I said, the benchmark is 40%. I would say if you're 50% there, you're still doing okay. Higher than that, and higher than 60%, and I'd start to worry. Actually, I wouldn't worry. I'd get to work and figure out what to do about it. But is it the land or is it the labor that's the problem? And the way to figure that out is to measure what's your gross product per FTE. So if your overheads are out of whack, and your gross product per FTE is good, then it must be land costs. If the overhead ratio is bad and the labor costs are bad, well, then labor costs are bad. Let's deal with that. I remember talking about that statistic, that gross product per FTE at a workshop several years ago. I think it was up in Calgary. And there's a young guy, he's probably 35. Anybody younger than me is young. Anyway, he came in and he was a little bit late. And you could tell he'd been working and barely made it to the workshop. And when I said this statistic of $250,000 per FTE, he turned to his friend and said, "Oh man, I wouldn't want to do that." I thought, "Well, why wouldn't he want to do that?" And it occurred to me later that he was raised the same way I was. Because I'll bet you know, the average in this industry is about $100,000 per FTE, you know, just barely covering their costs. Mm-hmm. Well, when I was a kid, if I needed money, my mom would tell me to do some chores or get a job. You know, the lesson we all learn is you have to work for your money. Well, I bet you he was raised the same way I was. And when he's looking at the statistic of most people earning $100,000, or not earning, but producing $100,000 of value for the company, and the benchmark being $250,000, he's thinking, I can't work 2.5 times harder. But that's the whole point right there, is that they're not working harder. They're letting, you know, they're getting in sync. They're restructuring enterprises, picking the right enterprise for the environment, and then structuring that enterprise to match the seasons so that nature's doing the heavy lifting. And the people who are earning or producing $250,000 of value for their outfit, those guys aren't working harder. They're not working harder. In fact, they're probably working less. And then if you think about the best day you had working, you know, like this morning, you said you went out and helped the bloke move some cows. Right. And when you were done with that, the cows removed, the gate was closed, everybody's fat and happy, and things are going good, and you probably felt really good about that. You produced a result, mm-hmm. and you were able to receive the result at the end of that. And there's nothing that's more satisfying to people than seeing results. Well, who produced more results? The guy that produced $250,000 of value, or the guy that produced $100,000 of value? Mm-hmm. And I'll guarantee you that person that's producing the $250,000 of value for their outfit, whether they own the outfit or whether they're just an employee, I'll bet you they're happier about the place and about their role in it, because they're producing results, and that feels great.
Yep. Very good. And I know that you are still in the workshop industry, because there's a workshop that you've just completed with the by the time this is released, you will have just completed the workshop with the South Dakota Grassland Coalition. So I guess I want to turn a little bit of the focus and talk a little bit about some of the experience you've had in debriefing with your time at Ranch Management Consultants. How has that experience been? Are there any things that are coming back to the surface as lessons learned over the number of years and decades you put into that business?
Yeah. I was just writing a list of things for Dallas that I'll probably rip up and not give to him, because I think you have to learn these things the hard way. I don't think it does mm-hmm. much good for anybody to tell you. I've always thought of myself, modesty aside, as a pretty good teacher. But one of the things we tell people at the school is, just because you know how to raise livestock doesn't mean you know how to run a business that raises livestock. Hmm. And it was probably, I don't know, maybe 10 years into this, because I've been running the company, my wife and I have been running it for 20 years. Maybe 8 or 10 years into it, I realized that just because you know how to teach doesn't mean you know how to run a business that does teaching. And that was taking a spoon of my own medicine there and thinking, geez, you know what, maybe I should spend less time in the classroom and more time on figuring out how to, on curriculum development and on training other people to be able to teach this thing, and on some of the other things that we've been doing that have really taken the company to another level. The other, I think maybe the other big thing is, you know, when Clinton was elected, he kept saying, it's the economy, stupid. And, you know, just keep focusing on that thing right there, regardless of whether how people feel about that or whether he was right or not, but the economy, stupid. And I think the same thing applies to us, is that it's the school. You know, there's a lot of other things we can do. And there's a lot of other things we have done. We've taught the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People course. We've done short courses. But there's nothing that, in terms of impact, there's nothing I've ever seen that compares to the Ranching for Profit School. Mm. And it's easy to take your eye off that ball because it's seductive. As a teacher, you want to go out and do programs and you want to do this. Oh, we could create this. We could create that. Hazel Parsons was Stan Parsons, or is Stan Parsons' wife, the man that founded our company. And she used to talk about making changes to the school as polishing buttons on a perfect suit. And I think that's right. But as a teacher in curriculum development, that's what you want to focus on, is, oh, let's tweak this and let's tweak that. But the school works the way it is. You know, there have been changes. I think one of the things we introduced to the school that made a big impact are producer videos. Some of our alumni, 3 to 5 minute videos, maybe 5 or 6 of them a day, talking about how they applied a particular concept. There's one of a woman in out of Arvada, Wyoming, Heidi Stoltz, that I did last year. And it's, to me, I almost tear up when I watch some of these things, because I know where these guys were and I know where they are now. And she said the video we use of hers is about economic planning and about being able to forecast a profit. How would you think you could forecast a profit when you don't know what's going to happen? But she was talking about how close they get and their frustration before they knew how to do this. Because she'd say, we needed to do the numbers. We wanted to do the numbers, but we didn't know how to do the numbers. And just, I know I'm taking some squirrel trails here this morning. I appreciate you humoring me. But those are the kinds of things that we've added to the school, but it really is polishing buttons. I was going through, you know, we're throwing out a lot of stuff. I can't tell you how many recycling bins I've filled with, with old notebooks and things like that. And I was taking a look at some of old Stan's old stuff. And the core curriculum hasn't changed. You know, from the time I first took the school in 1988, I think it was, the core curriculum hasn't changed. But the way we teach it, we have polished those buttons on that perfect suit, that they are pretty shiny. But so I guess I guess there's a third thing too. So the first thing is that just because you know how to teach doesn't mean you know how to run a business that does teaching. The second thing is, don't take your eye off the school. You know, that's the thing that really has an impact. And I think the third thing is to recognize what the purpose of the school is. And I remember the very first class I taught, it was in Australia. And it was in Dubbo, Australia. And I think the reason Stan had me teach it in Australia, because the further you go away from home, the more people think you know. So, you know, in Australia, they'd think I was something else. I had a really bad day in the classroom. I mean, it was the first time you do anything, you're not going to be great. And I was way less than great. I had forgotten what a trading account was. And a trading account is the tool you use to calculate gross product, which we just talked about. And I was supposed to be teaching economics, and it was gone. It blew out of my head. And Stan took me aside that night and said, Dave, do you even know what this school is for? Oh my gosh. And I came up with an answer that I thought sounded good anyway. I said, yeah, it's to give people the tools to build sustainable businesses. And he just shook his head. He said, no. This school has one purpose, and that's to change the way people think. And at the time I thought, no, come on, it has to be bigger than that. And I've come to learn that that's everything. In the 7 Habits program, they use a very simple model. It says see, do, get. And it's based on this idea. To get different results, you need to do things differently. But you will not do things differently until you see things differently. You know, if the way I look at the industry, the way I see my ranch, I've got to wean a big calf to make a profit. If that's what I believe, then I'll do the things it takes to wean a big calf. And the results that I get, I'll get a big calf. I will not get different results until I do things differently, but I will not do things differently until I change my paradigm that maybe it's not about that big calf. Maybe it's about something else. And that's what Stan was talking about. It's to shift the way people, the way they see their business, to shift their paradigms. And it took a while to knock that in my head. But I think that's one of the things that's important to keep in mind when somebody's teaching the school. People do learn how to crunch the numbers. They do learn how communication skills. They do learn how to plan profit a year ahead of time. They do learn cell grazing. They learn all these things, but that's not the purpose of the school, because they won't make any changes until they change their paradigm about ranching and their relationship to ranching. And I think that's the other big thing, is that the purpose of the school is very, very simple. And it may be the most difficult thing that you can do, and that's to change the way people think. It's a really exciting thing when you see it happen, though.
Absolutely. Very, very good. I really appreciate that. And I have a friend who attended the school, a very, very close friend of mine, and he kind of was in a traditional ranching operation and attended the school. And I want to share a testimonial with you from him as a thank you for your investment in this school. So here we go. He says this: as far as processing the week's info, I have to say the school outperformed any expectation I could have ever had. To be honest, it was the biggest life-changing experience I've ever had outside of my relationship with God, marrying my wife, and seeing my children take their first breath. I'm still coming down off an emotional high that I never expected to have to begin with. The school was about ranching for profit, but also a great share was about giving people profit in their own life again. I feel like at the end of the conference, the largest goal was to see people improve their lives and be forward thinkers. If they could accomplish that, the ranch would profit automatically. From here, we have much planning and much work to do to alter our structure to a point of profitability in simplicity.
Wow. There's somebody who got it. There's somebody who really got it. And I love the way he ends that with simplicity. You know, if things are too complicated, something's wrong. This was it Tom Lasseter, I think, said that the cattle business is a very simple business. The complicated part is keeping it simple. And we do all sorts of things to really complicate it. And it actually is very, very simple. But that's cool. That's exciting for me to hear. In fact, I got tears in my eyes hearing that, because there's somebody who's, I was telling Dallas that when in 2009, when the economy was crashing, here's another lesson I learned. When times are tough, people tend to hold on. You know, they're not going out. They're just trying to hang on and survive. 2009, when the economy crashed, people were holding on and they were not enrolling in the school. Enrollment probably crashed by 50%. I mean, it was bad for us. We lost a lot of money. If we'd had 2 years in a row like that, Ranch Management Consultants would be done. We wouldn't be here. And I recognized that if we were going to hang on, then nothing was going to change, that we had to take a different approach, that we had to invest. And we invested in training with Seven Habits. That's when we started teaching the Seven Habits program. I invested in training on something called 7-8 sales, which is done by a friend of mine in Australia, I used to think that sales is about selling stuff. It's not. Sales is not about making money. Sales, if you do it right, is about helping people solve problems. Hmm. I used to hate sales. You know, I felt like sales was pushing stuff at people. But when you take that approach, that sales is about helping people solve problems, well, that really changes the dynamics. I want to, you know, this morning you helped somebody solve a problem. You probably felt great about that. You know, I like helping people solve problems. And if the school can help solve a problem, then fantastic. Let's get into it. That's, I'm going down another rabbit trail, but maybe that's another podcast to do, is to get into the sales and some of the tools people need I won't go there. That's another topic for another day. But anyway, just that's exciting for me to hear this guy. It's he got it.
Well, he's put his money where his mouth is. They are restructuring their business, and it's been fun to be kind of a standby onlooker, I guess, to that process and see that they're they're going through the steps to make that not only an economically profitable business, but an emotionally, you know, and all of the other mentally profitable business
I bet you it's going to be a more fun business.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. I was down in Mexico the other, couple of weeks ago and doing a 2-day program down there. And we were talking about the best measure of success in business. And what is the best measure of success? And I think part of it, I think it boils down to three things. One, is it profitable? Because if it's not profitable, it's not a business, it's just a hobby. But is it economically profitable? Two, is it too much work? Because if it's too much work, it's not going to survive. It's going to burn us out, and the next generation isn't going to want to do it. And the third thing is, are we having fun? And I think if we get those three things right, the ecology takes care of itself. Because if the land is sick, it's not going to be profitable. It's going to be way too much work, and there's no way it's going to be fun. So we don't even have to include ecology in this definition of success when it comes to ranching. It's really, is this thing making a sustainable profit? Is the workload appropriate? And are we having fun? And I think that's a question we don't ask nearly often enough. Are we having fun? I mean, we only go around this thing once.
Right.
I think sometimes we treat life as though it was something that was going to happen later. you know, so yeah, we can't just be playing in the day without thinking about tomorrow. But, you know, it's not just about the destination. We got to enjoy the trip.
Right.
Yeah. That makes sense?
Absolutely. No, yeah, it's for sure. I understand what you're saying. Well, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate your investment in ranchers. I appreciate you being willing to, you know, every time it's been a very quick turnaround with you setting up an interview, and you've always been so willing to serve. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm retired, right? So I got all the time in the world.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You've been doing workshops pretty regularly. Do you have any big plans for your retirement?
I plan to write another book in about a month. I'll get started on that. Actually, I've got a draft worked out, but there's pre-work we use for the Ranching for Profit School in Dallas. And I felt for years like it needed to be rewritten, but it was a relatively low priority given other projects that we had. And anyway, I asked Dallas if there's a role he'd like me to play, and he said he'd like me to rewrite the pre-work. So I had that in my mind anyway. So I'll be doing that. He's busy in November with Executive Link, and so he's asked me to do a couple of workshops that he would like to have done but isn't able to. And I told him that if something happens, I'm happy to be the substitute teacher if something happens to somebody at the last minute. You know, I figure the Beach Boys are, you know, 75 or 80 years old, but they're out there. They're still out there doing Surfer Girl. You know, I can roll out of bed and still do the Three Secrets. I'll be doing some of that. He's asked me to do one of the schools coming up this winter. It'll just be a much slower pace, but it'll be up to him. I really don't want to interfere with the direction he wants to take the company. I think he has some very exciting plans, but I am prepared to support him in any way I can.
Is there any place for people to keep up with your schedule online, or is it just kind of pay attention to your local Grazing Land Coalition and other places where they might be bringing you in?
I'll bet you that Dallas, if I'm doing workshops, any workshop I do is going to be with the blessing of RMC. I'm not going to contract with somebody unless Dallas, I'm going to throw it to Dallas. And if he wants to do the workshop, he can do the workshop. If he'd prefer to have me do it, then fantastic. But with that in mind, I have a hunch that they'll be listed on the RMC website.
Okay.
So I don't know if these ones coming up. There's one that's coming up in Washington in the middle of November.
Okay.
Which is another one he wasn't able to do. But we'll get that. You know, things are tough in a transition. Dallas has been running the company for, today would be 1 week. That he took over Tuesday last week. So we're going to be the next week or so. I think there'll be a few wrinkles that get ironed out, but we'll get those workshops up on the website, I think. And that's the best way for people to follow what I'm doing.
Yep. And there will be links in that to that in the show notes page at workingcows.net/114. So if you have any questions about that, check out workingcows.net/114, and we'll get the most relevant links there. So Dave, thank you for your time today.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, I feel like that was a pretty unique opportunity to talk to Dave and to get some perspective from him. So really appreciate his time and look forward to future conversations with him, and really look forward to the Livestock Marketing School with Wally Olson in Claremore, Oklahoma, November 12th through the 15th. Also, we'll be talking next week on the Working Cows podcast with Brian Alexander about his strip grazing experiment. So if you are interested in that, I would encourage you to check out episode 115 of the Working Cows podcast coming your way as soon as possible next week. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.